1, 2, 1, 2. Are we on? It is John Pollock and Eric Marcotte. Take two of the UFC 299 review. 2 minutes and 22 seconds that outside of Brandon from New Jersey, hopefully no one will ever see as just disaster struck. Welcome to our review of Saturday night's card from Miami. We're tired. We are reacting to the time difference. What's going on, Eric? Is the world just coming apart at the seams?
It does seem like one of those days where everything that could go wrong is going wrong. But unlike you, I will remember that 2 minutes and 26 second stream very fondly.
Well, it's already been permanently deleted from YouTube. As what you missed was me frozen as my main computer froze and crashed as we went live, and thus I could hear Eric and was not moving. And there you have it. Well, here we are to chat about UFC 299 from the Kaseya Center in Miami, Florida on Saturday night. The UFC boasting a gigantic gate that they drew for this, over $14 million that they announced for this show in Miami, headlined by Sean O'Malley and Marlon Vera. And a lot of the discussion, Eric, was the obvious comparisons between this card and UFC 300. And I mean, this certainly felt like a big card this week, a big UFC event, hardly just a layup before next month's card in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of UFC 199, which happened right ahead of 200 mm-hmm. and was, in its own right, a completely stacked card from top to bottom. I thought on paper that this card looked amazing. I don't think it's quite as stacked as 300 looks, but it's probably going to be your second best pay-per-view of the year just in terms of name value throughout scattered throughout this card.
How interesting was this main event for you going in with Marlon Vera holding the victory over Sean O'Malley in 2020? This was where Sean O'Malley sustained the leg injury that, I mean, Sean O'Malley's side is, well, that was a total fluke. Unfortunately, someone had to inflict that damage on him, which was Marlon Vera. So, I mean, the improvements of Sean O'Malley from 2020 to last night, I mean, are immense. So how intriguing of a bantamweight fight was this for you?
That's an interesting question. In one aspect, I would say I was interested in what this fight could be if both fighters fought to their full potential. But if you will even go back to the previous pay-per-view show we did, I cautioned that with saying sometimes Marlon Vera has a habit of not doing much offensively, and it can lead to him losing a lot of rounds in some dull fights. So I knew that was also a strong possibility, and well, that is what we got.
Well, we are going to get into the main event. Sean O'Malley making the first defense of his UFC bantamweight championship that he won from Aljamain Sterling back at UFC 292. For Marlon Vera, he's won five of his last six. In that stretch, he did have the split decision loss to Corey Sandhagen, but was coming off a win over Pedro Munhoz last August. And, of course, they did meet back in August of 2020, which I did rewatch this week, and I cannot watch these cards from... There is a difference between our typical Apex cards now and the pandemic Apex cards, where it is the environment is just atrocious. I mean, there's a certain intrigue of watching like a major fight and there's no sound at all. But man, it gets old very quick.
Yeah, I don't mind watching the fights themselves in that environment, but some of the moments that would occur after the fights were the ones that I was like, wow, I can't believe that happened in front of nobody. Like that very card, right, is Stipe Miocic versus Daniel Cormier in Daniel Cormier's last ever MMA fight as he retires in front of literally nobody. The same thing happened to Anderson Silva, I believe. It was not something that I'm keen to revisit. The fight itself, though, whatever.
But I mean, years gone by now. I mean, the idea of doing like major fights now inside of the UFC Apex, I mean, when you're... a company that can do a $14 million gate. I mean, thankfully, we've moved on significantly from those days, right? So we go into the fight. They went the full five rounds, and right off the top, I thought this was a fantastic performance from Sean O'Malley. I would say the most complete performance we have ever seen from him. He starts off the fight. I mean, Marlon Vera is notoriously a slow starter, and that was the case here, where it was Sean O'Malley immediately going to the body and just building up offense, delivering kicks, mixing in his left hand. Into the second round, O'Malley is throwing a head kick, and then I would say the strike of the fight is this knee right down the middle. I don't know if Kazuyuki Fujita would have withstood this knee. It was so flush to Vera's head, and he just withstood this to the point that I was waiting to cast judgment until we saw the replay. I was like, maybe he didn't hit him as flush as we thought. The sound certainly made it seem like, no, this replay, he hit him as solidly as a knee is going to connect, and this dude ate it, and it was stunning that he was not finished from this knee.
And to clarify, for anybody who may be listening to this but didn't actually watch the fight, not only did he take this knee, he wasn't even rocked. Like, he was fine.
He didn't wobble or have to react. It was as though he had been hit with, like, a jab, and it was like he just walked through it completely. It was stunning. But this certainly did not change the one-way action that we were getting, at least in the early portion of this. O'Malley is tagging him comfortably up two rounds going into round number three, and we're seeing jabs set up by the right hand from O'Malley and just switching stances, being effective from both ends, and just well ahead here. Vera does land with a right hand and a jab, does get does slip at the end, and then we go into the fourth round. I would say this was Vera's best round. He incorporated some more like dirty boxing and getting at least some combinations in, but it was still an O'Malley round for me, working at distance, great combination in the last minute, and again, digging to the body.
Yeah, 100%. This was the closest round of the fight, and again, almost a bit, I'm trying to think of the right word, infuriating seems a bit strong, but knowing that whenever Vera, and it wasn't just this round, whenever Vera pressured forward and created offense, he found success. Like, their exchanges were at worst 50-50 for him, and you can argue he's the heavier hitter between the two. So, we've seen this a lot from him over the years, especially in recent time. This was just one of those fights where he wasn't able to create those opportunities for himself.
The person that did cause a major storm was one Terrence McKinney, because after four rounds, he noted on his scorecard it was 2-2.
What?
So,
oh my God.
At 1:14 a.m., he tweets out 2-2 for me. Then at 1:24 a.m., he, after getting a barrage of suspect responses to this bizarre scorecard, he just wrote, "I'm trolling. I had it 4-1 at the end." So I would go back and I would state that, okay, we will give you the caveat that you are walking back your 2-2 card. Still giving one round to Marlon Vera, still questionable, I would state, in even his non-trolling updated scorecard. I cannot find a round here for Marlon Vera, and I've got a big flashlight and am still searching.
No, it's not happening. I can't see an argument for any round. You can argue he won some exchanges. Yeah, sure. An entire round, not happening. Sorry, Terrence.
So, I mean, Jason Perillo is, to his credit, I mean, he was never sugarcoating this, where this fight was going for Vera, that you are down. He knew he needed a finish in the final two rounds, and going into the fifth is just giving him the biggest speech possible. This will change your life. But Vera gets stunned with a right hand, and it's O'Malley continuing to the body, piling up pressure. Vera starts indicating an issue he's having with his eye, and then it's Vera with a knee up the middle in the last minute and takes a left hook to the body at the end. Shutout for Sean O'Malley on my scorecard. I had it 50-45, two judges having it the same, one going as far as 50-44, which I will always encourage more 10-8s, but I think we're in an era now where we're kind of back to the old way where you pretty much have to kill a guy to get a 10-8 round, regardless of how you scored it. This was a clean sweep for Sean O'Malley, and I thought his most complete performance. He was just so head and shoulders above Marlon Vera over five rounds.
at the very least, I'd say his best performance against this level of competition. Really great stuff from him. His hands looked fantastic throughout, great footwork. Like I said, it was a bit stressful almost to watch at times, knowing that Vera was capable of so much more. But that's Marlon Vera for you. That's the fighter he is, especially as he gets older. He used to be a fighter who kind of had the Piotr Jan thing going for him, where he would be a slow starter who would pick it up as the fight goes on. As time has progressed, he's become more of a fighter who looks for big moments more so than really pouring on that pressure. And I feel like that's what kept him so hesitant at times throughout this fight, allowing him to fall so far behind O'Malley in terms of the overall strike count.
O'Malley landed 232 of 358 total strikes, compared to Marlon Vera landing 89 of 241. So just a gigantic output in comparison by Sean O'Malley. Total number of takedowns attempted by both men over 25 minutes, zero.
Yeah, I was actually a bit surprised. Not that Vera takes his opponents to the ground often, but I thought it is something, a route that he might go down after technically finishing the fight on the ground in their prior match, but never even considered it.
Sean O'Malley is interviewed afterwards, and I mean, it's the obvious opponent. Everyone has been clamoring for the bantamweight champion. He wants to fight Ilia Topuria. I mean, finally, like the fight that's just... there for the taking, and there, and then he does clarify at the end, I'll also knock out Marab if that's what people want. And I think that is what people want, and it certainly sounded like that is what Dana wants as well after the fact. I do not see Sean O'Malley and Ilia Topuria happening anytime soon.
Topuria is too busy calling out Conor McGregor, so
none of these guys want to stay in their weight classes, so that was probably not the likely call out there. And I think that this is Merab Dvalishvili's fight, and I think it's as compelling a fight as you're going to be able to make. That is just another level for Sean O'Malley, and will probably be the underdog in that fight, but I'm very intrigued by it.
I echo your sentiments. I think he will be the underdog going into that one, but that's not to say it's not a winnable fight either. We've seen Merab lose. We've seen him get hurt. We've seen fighters keep the fight on the feet for him throughout their entire bout, so that there is definitely a route to victory for Sean O'Malley. I'm really into that fight, and I hope that is what we see and not Sean O'Malley versus Ilia Topuria.
What's your expectation on the timeline? If there are not any extenuating circumstances, both fighters are on board for that fight, what would you see as like the timeline for that? Do you see that by end of summer, the fall? Where would you be aiming for that fight?
What are we in? We can probably get that around International Fight Week, honestly.
June. Oh, man, you're just expediting this. Let's get it out there. Let's get it on 300. I mean, what are they doing?
Neither of them.
By the way, was the backup fighter and weighed in for this card as well. It blows my mind, the idea. Like, let's say Marlon Vera missed weight, and he had a hell of a weight cut to get there, or got hurt in the process. You're going to fight Merab Dvalishvili on 24 hours notice, really?
He always has the opportunity to just say no. It's the UFC bringing Merab in, like, hey, make weights, we'll get you paid. Sean O'Malley can still just say no, I'm not fighting him.
Like, that's insane. And it would be painted as Sean O'Malley. He didn't want to fight. He didn't want to fight. Yeah, he didn't want to fight the number one guy in the division on 24 hours notice. No. And he would completely be painted as the bag. It makes no sense to me at all. I would never, ever champion a guy taking a fight on short notice like that.
Oh no, especially against a fighter like that would be a completely different stylistic matchup.
Well, we're gonna go to another five round fight on the card. It was Dustin Poirier taking on Benoit Saint-Denis, a lightweight fight scheduled for five rounds. This was one that had a bit of a roller coaster in terms of the announcement for the fight, then the fight had not been signed, then Dana White revealed his text exchange with one side, with Benoit Saint-Denis, that, hey, he agreed to it. It's like, yeah, I think both guys have to agree to a fight. I think that's how this thing all works. And then they got Dustin Poirier inked up, and the fight is moving forward. And I mean, this was every person that brought up the fact, what does Dustin Poirier gain from this? In hindsight, you can look at it. I think this will be one of those fights that people will look back on in a very positive way for Dustin Poirier. But going in, I mean, this was a guy ranked third against the number 12 ranked guy who's on this hot streak. And this was all risk for Dustin Poirier. But as we can see in the way this came out, there was also some reward hidden in there, too, given the performance he put forward.
Yeah, this was the main event of the card for me. It was from the second it was announced. Yes, this was a huge step up in competition for Saint Denis, but he's an entertaining fighter. He knows how to force finishes. And while I didn't really like his chances in winning this fight, I knew it was going to be very entertaining for however long it lasted.
You didn't see Dustin Poirier as a plus 185 underdog.
I thought those odds were insane, like absolutely insane. Who has Dustin Poirier lost to, like some of the greatest fighters of all time, against the man who hasn't fought a ranked opponent yet? I could not believe it. Some, like, we've talked about this over and over again. I feel far too often we put too much stock into a fighter's last fight. And getting head kick KO'd by Justin Gaethje doesn't mean that Dustin Poirier's lost the step.
Dustin Poirier, this is his 29th fight in the UFC. I mean, this guy was coming up on like the Louisiana circuit where God knows how many undocumented fights are on his record. But let's just look at the last 3 years of this lineup of fights. He has the two wins over Conor McGregor, submission loss to Charles Oliveira, submits Michael Chandler, and then knocked out by Justin Gaethje. And then he is going into Benoit Saint-Denis. This guy was massacred in his UFC debut outside the weight class, but regardless, comes back, wins five in a row, including three wins last year. But at the end of the day, like, he's coming off a win over Matt Frivola, which, all due respect to Matt Frivola, but this was a massive leap for Benoit Saint-Denis, and it seemed that everyone was ready for this kind of coronation while at the same time believing like this was the crossroads for Dustin Poirier's career. But this was kind of a reminder of like the levels, especially in a deep weight class like lightweight.
Exactly. So.
So the fight begins, and Poirier, obviously, he probably was taking a look at DraftKings and what was the prop bet on a Dustin Poirier win by guillotine. And he was thinking, you know what, let's make someone's day by landing this guillotine, because he was obsessed with getting this guillotine. And Benoit Saint-Denis is escaping out of it. And not only would Poirier go for these guillotines, but in leaping for them, he would end up like ending up in a bad position on top of it underneath Benoit Saint-Denis, who they battled in the clinch, and Poirier is against the fence, but Poirier then counters, cutting Saint-Denis, and then again pops out of another guillotine, and Benoit Saint-Denis gets the back at the end while getting in his hooks. They go to their corners after the first round, and Mike Brown tells Dustin Poirier, no more guillotines. Dustin's like, yes, coach, no problem. So he comes out, immediately lands with a left hand. What does he follow up with? Time for that guillotine. I'm hitting that prop bet. And he goes, loses the guillotine. Benoit Saint-Denis mounts him. But then it's Poirier getting out of a bad position from a neck crank, gets to his feet, and he hits these pair of strikes and wobbles Saint-Denis. Goes, of course, for another guillotine on the feet. I was like, you got a guy wobbled. That neck is open. And then a left hand sets up the right hand of God, which puts down Benoit Saint-Denis, and then straight out of Dan Henderson and Michael Bisping, this coffin nailer, dude. Like, it was so ugly. This last shot, it was the kill shot of all kill shots. And I wish so much Mike Beltran had gotten there a second earlier, so this guy did not have to take this last blow, because he was out. And this Dustin Poirier hit him with everything with this last shot. 2 minutes and 32 seconds of the second round, Dustin Poirier wins by knockout, his 22nd UFC victory.
Where to even start with this? What a fun fight while it lasted. Saint-Denis really, just as I think most people expected, he pushed that pace early, and he was finding a lot of success against Dustin in the first round. Yes, he ate some shots on his way in, but he was landing big ones. His grappling, he clearly was the better grappler between the two, but Dustin Poirier has been here so often over the years. And when he really started letting loose in that second round, some of those shots that he was hitting Saint-Denis with were just beautiful, a crisp combos to the body and the head, and the knockout shot, absolutely brutal. A beautiful finish. Definitely could have been stopped a second earlier, to say, if Benoit Saint-Denis some brain trauma. That was, I mean, you say Henderson, Bisping, that might have been Ngannou Overeem level after the guy got uppercutted into the fifth row.
It was the combination. Yeah, he took the bad end of both of those fights.
He was like dropped three times right before that too. So definitely a very damaging sequence there. But hey, the real highlight of all of this is the post fight interview, where Joe Rogan brings up Dustin Poirier going for that guillotine over and over again. He's even, hey, your coach Mike Brown, he told you to stop doing that. And what does Dustin Poirier say? I'm never gonna stop. I actually laughed. I died.
And then we got, what a reflective moment. You're the man, Dustin Poirier. I'm just a man, Joe Rogan.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Dustin, just a man, Poirier wins, improves to 30-8 with one no contest. And I mean, this might be a crazy thought to have at the end of this one, but maybe not, is that, you know, Dustin Poirier did take, and readily admitted, took some damage in leading to this second round and finishing Benoit Saint-Denis. And there was part of me that was like, this is the ultimate walk out to the into the sunset type of end, if you wanted to be Dustin Poirier. He is not going to end his career, but what a note this would be, because there will come a time where we will see Dustin Poirier absorb this damage and will not have the capacity to turn things around as he did in this fight. And I mean, he obviously wants that elusive title, an undisputed version. I don't know if he will ever be able to do that. He is 35 now. I mean, he has been through an enormous series of wars, but I mean, this was a outstanding performance. And for what you could have looked on as a fight that had very little stakes for Dustin Poirier, it is one of those fights that I think is going to define him to many people in terms of the fact that he took this fight and ending him in such devastating fashion.
I mean, you talk about Dustin Poirier's last fight. You'll know it's his last fight, because when Dustin Poirier steps into the octagon for the final time, he is going to jump for that guillotine so many goddamn times. And he's not actually going to lay those gloves down until he finally gets it. It's going to be Ric Flair hitting the move off the top rope after all those years. Dustin Poirier finally sinking in that guillotine. You know what? You talk about him being 35, and that window is definitely closing. I would not favor him against Islam Makhachev. But when I look at the other people in that conversation right now, I look at Mateusz Gamrot, Charles Oliveira, Justin Gaethje, Armin Tsarukyan, perhaps. These are fighters that Dustin Poirier can beat. He has beat Justin Gaethje. The last one didn't go his way, but he proved he was able to hurt Oliveira in his fight as well. Certain results would definitely have to go his way for that path to open up again, but I wouldn't say the window is completely shut yet either.
No, I don't think so either, and this is a win that will probably catapult him into that discussion. He's a major name, and I think the idea of him fighting for the title again is certainly a possibility. As close as his next fight, like, that is a very real possibility after this one. So a really entertaining fight, and this ended up getting the fight of the night bonus later on. Then we go to the debut of Michael Venom Page in the UFC. He fought for the lesser known Other Organizations FC. Are you familiar with them?
You know, I can't say I'm familiar with Other Organizations FC. I think my favorite one was when they're showing like this amateur 280p like Taekwondo practice like footage. Like, yeah, this is what we all know him for. These are the highlights he's made his name off of.
Yeah, I mean, he comes in. I mean, it is something to be said that we still can't say the B word on a UFC broadcast. I mean, don't want to give any more momentum for that rising tide that is the Bellator brand. I mean, that could put them over the top as like a new force if their name was uttered on a UFC broadcast.
The UFC is absolutely ridiculous for this one. My God, I could have sworn that they like walked that back. I thought they would. They brought up Bellator when Michael Chandler was making his debut, but I guess Bellator has grown too hot since then. They can't get add any more fuel.
All these international cards are like they're a global force now. So, Kevin Holland is the opponent. Did you like this as a first opponent for Michael Venom Page in terms of? Just a first opponent for him. I mean, they were not putting him in there with a guy that was going to, he was not fighting Logan Storley here. Although Kevin Holland does have grappling, but I don't think too many people anticipated that as part of his game plan.
Yeah, I thought it was a sensible first matchup. You're talking about a guy who's been like a mainstay of the rankings for a while now, an entertaining fighter who is probably going to fight a Michael Page style of fight as well. Go ahead. Well,
we got a great showcase of Michael Venom Page, who was, I mean, instantly incorporating his very unique style that was frustrating Kevin Holland throughout the fight. And Page just coming in for like single shots, but with a lot of force behind them, just in and out with his right hand or that landed flush early on. Page was actually the one to initiate the clinch several times in the first round, and Holland is just struggling to get any meaningful offense in. This continued into the second. Holland lands with a big right hand, and Page had a slip, and then Holland gets a body lock, takes him down and tries for a choke, is landing elbows on top, but then Page gets up and there's a right hand that drops Page, and he comes back with a spinning elbow, one of several that he landed. This was an exceptionally close round. How did you go in round two, and what was your score going into the third round?
Yeah, so I went back and quickly rewatched this round because it was the one that I struggled the most with. Watching it live, I did score it for Holland. I thought that he would landed the better shots throughout the first 4 minutes, undoubtedly, including those ones from top position. The part I wanted to kind of re-examine was the final minute, where Page seemingly lands two very strong shots, one that seems to knock Holland down. And I wanted to see if that was a knockdown or a trip. And it looks like it's a bit more of a trip. So I scored the round for Holland. Very close, though.
Well, the third, it was a... This is a great lesson, okay? I have always been a detractor of the let's fist bump as we start off our round of combat here. So Holland puts out his fist, and Page seemed to be pretty contrite afterwards because he drops him with this 1-2 combination and immediately feels bad that he was not reading the situation properly. That said, this absolutely counts, okay? You landed this combination. And if you were someone like this, could have been even going into the third round, and you're putting out your fist, whether the guy has intentions or not to take advantage of that situation, if he lands a shot on you, this is in regulation time and that counts. And I, you know what? Fist bump after the fight, hug after the fight, whatever you want. Let's save our pleasantries for the end. I think it's just a silly thing that I understand there's a mutual respect in the heat of the battle. But I mean, in this situation, like you got tagged, and it might have been, you might have looked at this guy as a poor sport, but this is, you got 5 minutes to win this fight.
I thought MVP's reaction to this one was pretty funny. You know, I have no problem with the fist bumps and whatnot at the start of the final rounds, but sometimes it gets a bit excessive. Remember the Korean zombie Yair Rodriguez fight? A great fight, but a fight in which Yair Rodriguez was like gassed by the fourth round. So he was just trying to hug. He was just trying to hug Zombie every couple seconds. Like after every exchange, he tried to initiate a hug, and Zombie's a nice guy, so he goes along with it over and over and over again. And sure enough, they do one last hug before the final exchange, where Yair lands the elbow that ends.
Should have waited to hug till the final second.
Yeah, exactly. So it can get excessive.
So he lands another spinning elbow. This swells up Holland's left eye, and it was Page, I think, convincingly winning rounds one and three. I did give him the second, so I had it 30-27, but all three judges having it 29-28. So Michael Venom Page gets the victory. And I mean, the biggest factor for Michael Venom Page is he is 36, and he is not that far away from 37. And I mean, he has such an entertaining style that I think he will be fast tracked. They like time is not on his side. The question will be, number one, the age factor. Number two, we know what the strategy is to beat a Michael Venom Page, because we have seen him against high level wrestlers and where he struggles against. And I mean, this was a favorable fight in that sense, that I don't think too many people expected a wrestling heavy game plan from Kevin Holland.
I imagine they'll give him the Michael Chandler treatment, in the sense that he was going to be getting some big names. And if he makes the most of those opportunities, I can see him really rising those rankings fast.
He's going to get Conor McGregor at 170.
You say that as a joke.
I say that out loud. I don't even.
Honestly, I think they'll probably give him Stephen Thompson. That seems like the logical, similar styled fighter to pair him up with.
Yeah, they had the two ended up at a gym together, and they featured them on Embedded together, just like buddy buddy and everything. And I just, part of me is looking at, are they just throwing out that C? Because that is the fight that I think everybody wants to see, and just having them on screen together, it's definitely getting that idea out there on a UFC platform. But I think that would be a perfect follow-up for Michael Venom Page. And if he can beat a Stephen Thompson, like, he will be in the mix of the bigger names at 170. Gilbert Burns against Jack Della Maddalena. Again, following the theme of sort of like a rising star in the weight class against the established veteran. And again, Jack Della Maddalena was the favorite, I should say, at minus 160 for this one. In the opening round, it's a Burns shooting for a single, getting back control. And Jack Della Maddalena is landing several lefts to the body and counters. It's Burns with the takedown at the end and landing a hammer fist at the end. Into the second, it's Burns fighting for takedowns and lands an elbow, swelling up the eye of Della Maddalena. And then Burns hits a big overhand right that just cracks him and gets his fifth takedown of the fight and his back by the end of things. So that sets up our third round. Very well could have been even going into the final round. And it's Burns with a head kick, and Della Maddalena counters with several big strikes, going to the body. Burns gets cut. And then Burns has him down by the cage, gets on top, and Della Maddalena rolls out, and he drops Burns with this knee and lands these huge elbow strikes, finishing Gilbert Burns by knockout at 3:43 of the third round. A very impressive win for Della Maddalena, who now is 7-0 in the UFC, 17-2 overall. And then maybe the most stunning, calling out Shavkat Rakhmonov, which, I mean, is the boogeyman of this 170-pound weight class. And, I mean, huge win for Della Maddalena. And of the kind of theme of the rising stars, I mean, this was the one that, to me, really jumped up in his respective weight class on Saturday.
For sure. I thought it was a very good fight. I did have Burns up going into the final round. And with Burns controlling the vast majority of this round, I want to say I knew the result of this fight as I was watching it. And we have, let's say, 90 seconds remaining in the bout, and Gilbert Burns is practically on this guy's back. And I'm just asking myself, how does this guy get knocked out in the next 15 seconds? But the transition that Della Maddalena did, where he scrambles out from underneath him, and as Burns tries to re-engage, he throws the perfect knee up the middle. One man could take that knee, and he was in the main event. Gilbert Burns, not so lucky, crashes down. And we talked about a late stoppage in the Poirier-St. Denis fight, but I think if there was a number one ranking for late stoppage, I'd probably go with this one, because Gilbert Burns ate so many elbows on the ground here. A fantastic win for Jack Della Maddalena, but a brutal, brutal finish.
Yeah, the third round, Jack Della Maddalena outlanded him 35-0.
And I'm betting like 25 of those were those elbows the end, at the end.
Yeah, there were a lot of heavy strikes on top before Dan Morgliotta decided, you know what, I think Gilbert Burns has had enough here. So a big win for Jack Della Maddalena on the main card. And then we go to the opener on the pay-per-view portion, as Song Yadong was taking on former bantamweight champion Piotr Jan. And again, Jan was, I think, somewhat uncharacteristically overlooked here. The fact that he was coming off losses to Aljamain Sterling, Sean O'Malley, and Merab Dvalishvili. I mean, not the most unimpressive lineup of guys to have losses to, and a lot that thought he beat Sean O'Malley. So, I mean, regardless, if he was looking at a prospect of four consecutive losses and the fourth being Song Yadong, I think that would have definitely been a it would have been a really big hole that this guy would find himself in this deep weight class. But he came out here first round. It's Song Yadong that is landing with left hooks, going to the body, and then gets back control and sneaks in several strikes. It was a good round for Song Yadong in the first. And then the second, Yan starts throwing with uppercuts. He's having a lot of success with these. And then throws another uppercut with this perfectly timed takedown. He threw the uppercut. So Yadong is reacting to the uppercut, and boom, he just takes him down effortlessly and lands this brutal elbow at the end that cuts Yadong. And as we see in the third round, Joe Rogan is just amazed. He's cut over both of his eyes. He's cut over both eyes. I'm like, yeah, he is. That's really wild. He's cut. So there's a spinning wheel kick thrown by Yan that partially lands, continues with the uppercuts that are having success. Yadong is firing off jabs, and then Yan completes a takedown in the final minute, gets the full guard, is trying to set up a darce in the closing seconds, but convincingly winning the final two rounds. And that is how the judges scored this one, 29-28. And Piotr Yan scores his, gets out of the losing streak and scores the win here to improve to 17-5.
I'd have to imagine everybody has the same scorecard for this one. A slow start by Yan. Song looked great in the first round, and I'd say even the first part of the second round. But this was one of those classic Piotr Yan fights where he really just, once there comes a point in the fight where he's like, all right, I have, I know how you move now, and I'm going to start attacking. And that's exactly what this was. He had some really excellent body work in that second round, and you saw it take immediate effect. Still, I wouldn't say a bad performance from Song either. I wasn't sure how this fight was going to go for him, but he doesn't seem out of place against these top-ranked bantamweights.
No, I mean, he won the first round, and I would say, like, he is someone that I think in a division that had less depth to it, I would state that he would have, like, a higher ceiling. But this is just a really, really competitive division, and this was going to be a bit of a litmus test for him in terms of would he be graduating to that upper field. And for Piotr Yan, he remains, I would say, in that upper echelon of the weight class. Is there anyone that jumps out at you of what will be next for Piotr Yan? Because this was, I think this will eliminate a lot of the discussion over Piotr Yan like reaching his peak, and maybe that there is still a run in him left. Guy is 31 years old.
Let me preface this by saying I don't really want to see this fight, but what I think Piotr Yan's next fight will be is I think they will make Piotr Yan versus Marlon Vera. And that is a fight between two notorious slow starters that I think could end up being very
one
very
round cool. Fight.
Oh, if it was a one round fight, you would get your first unanimous 10-10 scorecard. It could be an interesting matchup as the fight progresses, but I do think that's a logical, just from a matchmaking perspective, sort of about the setup.
We go into the prelims and a pretty important fight at heavyweight, which we don't always get to boast about. Curtis Blaydes taking on Jailton Almeida. And it was Almeida the favorite heading into this fight. And Curtis Blaydes, he has won six of his last eight and does technically hold a victory over interim champion Tom Aspinall when Aspinall suffered that knee injury 15 seconds into their fight. But if you're Curtis Blaydes, you're going to use that win for all it's worth for commanding a rematch. But is coming off the TKO loss to Sergey Pavlovich in April of last year. While Almeida had Eric's fight of the year last year, it was a 5-round contest with Derek Lewis that he took the decision nod in. Nothing that like 5-round heavyweight action.
An all-time classic that I'm sure is ingrained in each and every one of our respective minds.
Well, Almeida gets the takedown, and Blaydes is getting to his feet, but Almeida never let go of his grip here. He just bear hugged this dude and just continually threw Curtis Blaydes down over and over. Blaydes is trying to get to his feet, right back down. By the end of this first round, Almeida scored 9 takedowns. It was completely one-sided. And I mean, look, to give you just a look at this opening round, we had a total of 8 strikes thrown by Jailton Almeida to 5 thrown by Curtis Blaydes. I thought those were high given what I watched here. I was like, where were these 8 strikes that Jailton Almeida not only threw, but also landed? He was perfect. 8 for 8 in total strikes.
Those numbers are almost unbelievable. 5 strikes for Curtis Blaydes, even? I struggle to believe that. But
yes. significant strikes, though. 0 of 0 for Jailton Almeida. Curtis Blaydes, 0 of 2 significant strikes. So, I mean, maybe there was like some head slapping that constituted total strikes. Into the second we go, and it's looking like, boy, buckle up for 3 rounds here of action here, as Jailton Almeida is going to be just cruising to a grapple heavy decision win. But he shoots in and Almeida just gets annihilated with strikes, elbows to the side of the head. I counted 17 total unanswered strikes here by Curtis Blaydes as Almeida was just done. This was like a Travis Brown in his heyday. Curtis Blaydes stops him 36 seconds into the second round, wins by TKO, and now having won 7 of 9, you knew exactly what he was saying on the mic. He says, hey, me and Tom Aspinall, we have unfinished business. Smart call out for him and building to, like, Tom Aspinall is in a really tough spot because John Jones and Stipe Miocic, they are on their island of the heavyweight division. And Aspinall, I would say Curtis Blaydes is as logical as of a contender for this interim title that most are probably going to view as the real heavyweight title.
Let me tell you right now, that's the fight that's going to happen. Tom Aspinall is never fighting John Jones. Tom Aspinall is never fighting Stipe Miocic. That fight's just never going to occur. A fight against Curtis Blaydes? Yeah, that might actually happen. So I say we see that one a bit later on in the year.
What's the percentage chance that John Jones and Stipe Miocic happens?
Oh, man, I'm going to be optimistic and say 60%. Just because both guys seem so set on it, like their refusal to fight anybody else, the fact that they're both so close to retirement. Stipe is retired, but it's not even pretend he's an active fighter. He's fought like one time in the last 5 years, so he's not an active fighter. This seems like tunnel vision for both of them, so I'm going to say 60%.
Yeah, it's one that, I mean, had it happened as scheduled, cool, but with such a long wait for this fight, it almost feels like you just want to get it over with. And it's not, I just think they've totally missed the timing on this fight. You could argue they already had that Stipe, I mean, he has not competed in so long, and it just feels as though, you know, you have this other, it's like the heavyweight division exists in the Tom Aspinall version, but this is the metaverse where we also have the John Jones heavyweight division. And it just feels like two separate things that are going on. And will they intersect at any point? You just want one to complete so we can have one linear division at the end of it.
There was a time I would have loved to see that fight. There is a time I probably even would have favored Stipe Miocic in that fight, but that sure. Time has long since passed. I'm not that interested in really what either guy's up to at this point. I'm not that interested in a fight that they may have together. Before we move on entirely, there isn't too much we can say about Curtis Blaydes from this fight, but Jailton Almeida, the way he threw Curtis Blaydes around for that first round, recording like 9 or 10 takedowns in 5 minutes against Curtis Blaydes, that tells me he could do that to anybody. Anybody in the world, he can do that against. He's a very flawed fighter. He's not very active offensively in terms of his striking. Obviously, he's not confident in his striking. It's something he'll have to work on. But there is potential there for Almeida to be an absolute killer if things align for him.
If he can just mix in some striking,
yes,
that can complete this, that can, I could very well see him getting a, like a Tai Tuivasa level opponent in the near future.
He's beating Tai Tuivasa, let me tell you that right now.
Because I see him at that level right now. Like, he is right in the middle of this. Like, this is not the deepest of heavyweight divisions as we talk about these two separate heavyweight divisions. I mean, it's very much colored by the sort of 3 or 4 interesting pieces of this heavyweight division. And then we get it like, Ciryl Gane is our number two heavyweight in this weight class, and we saw him against John Jones. Like, there is certainly an opening if someone can get on a run, and like it's telling that Curtis Blaydes has not fought for this title yet. And I mean, he had two losses to Francis Ngannou that really, really did hurt his campaign at heavyweight. And it's taken him years to be able to make his way. And now it does seem on the cusp of at least an interim title fight. Caitlin Cerminara, are you familiar with this debuting fighter?
When I saw the name on the card without the face to attach to it, I was very confused as to how this fight made this particular card, but somehow I managed to figure it out.
Yes. Caitlin Chookagian is now taking her married name, and she has been out for quite a while, since October of 2022 when she lost to Manon Fiorot, and is taking on the 25-year-old Macy Barber. Which, what was the notification on her phone? Was that the countdown clock to becoming a champion? Has that passed? That used to be her gimmick that was brought up in every single fight, that she was going to be the youngest champion. And I think that time has passed.
John Jones was 24, right?
I believe so. He won it in 2011. I think 24.
Then the time has passed, unfortunately. She will not be the one. She can still be the future, maybe, but...
Well, she has quietly put together five wins coming into this particular fight. And Caitlin Cerminara, which will take some getting used to, is sort of like your litmus test. If you're going to beat her, you can make it into the top end, but it's not always going to be the most entertaining of affairs. As Caitlin Cerminara, when you look, she has never won a fight in the UFC by stoppage. It has been decision city for Cerminara, and we were going to be adding to that total in this card. The first round, it's Barber with strikes in the clinch, and then a beautiful sprawl by Barber, and then landed a bunch of shots on top as they trade into the second. Cerminara did land a front kick, and then is landing with the left hand. Better timing here. And then the third round, Cerminara gets the brief takedown. Barber's up, follows with a combination, and then after a scramble to her feet, Barber works inside the clinch and gets a takedown near the end of the fight. So Macy Barber wins by unanimous decision, 30-27 twice and 29-28, extending her win streak to six, with the most impressive ones being the last fight against Amanda Hibas and now Caitlin Cerminara. So I do not feel she is championship level ready yet, but I mean, she does have this win streak now. And I mean, that is something. And they have promoted her fairly aggressively during her time in the UFC.
For sure. She was definitely somebody they got behind quickly. Now that she's won six straight fights, and especially against Caitlin Cerminara, that's going to mess with me for a while, especially against her, because she's been that test for so many people. If you look at the people that she's lost to over the years, it's like Valentina Shevchenko, Jessica Andrade, Manon Fiorot. It's a lot of your people who either went on to become champion or immediately got a title shot following that win. It wouldn't shock me if they throw her name out in that conversation going forward. I'm in the same boat as you. I don't know if she's actually ready for that, but it will get hard to deny that opportunity, especially in a shallow, shallow division.
Yeah, we've got... So, just to update on the flyweight division, we have Aaron Blanchfield and Manon Fiorot fighting in a couple of weeks in Atlantic City, which should produce the next contender. However, the wrench thrown into that is that Valentina Shevchenko and Alexa Grasso are going to be iced because they're going to do the next season of The Ultimate Fighter that starts in June, meaning, I mean, they will be, in theory, the next fight at flyweight, and this Blanchfield-Fiorot winner is probably going to have to take another fight, which is nuts, because both could fight for the title tomorrow, and I think they are more than capable challengers for Alexa Grasso, but... I mean, Macy Barber could end up fighting Blanchfield or Fiorot next. I mean, that could very well be the way this flyweight division plays out, because Grasso and Shevchenko aren't, if Tough starts in June, like we're talking the end of the summer, September, that they'll probably be on that Sphere card in just catering around Alexa Grasso.
Well, I mean, if we follow the Conor McGregor, Michael Chandler tough formula,
right.
These two might not fight for another 2 years. This might be a very long... Tom Aspinall, like, period on ice here. I think that's actually is what's going to happen. I think Macy Barber will probably end up fighting the winner of that upcoming fight, and that's how you'll determine who's next in line for a title shot.
Next fight was Tush Gamrot and Rafael Dos Anjos, who was fighting in, I think, his 150th UFC fight. It's actually his 35th. Fought three times in 2022, but coming off a decision loss to Vicente Luque last August. First round, it was RDA landing with a big knee, drilled him with the right hand. The round was pretty much broken in half, where RDA got significant damage in for the first half, and then he was taken down and did take some damage, but this was a lot. This was one where I feel it was the first half of the round sometimes gets forgotten by the second half of the round. And I gave this round to RDA based on what he was able to inflict. Second round, though, it's Gamrot taking the back, holding him against the cage, just all control by Gamrot, and landed several jabs and a right hand over the top at the end. Third round, perfect takedown by Gamrot, and RDA escapes, gets back to his feet, and it's Gamrot who ups his takedown number to 11 by the end of the round and continues with strikes. Gets the unanimous nod, 30-27, and two scorecards of 29-28, as Gamrot has won seven of his last eight fights.
I had a 29-28 as well. RDA is a guy who is very much in his prime, a jack of all trades kind of fighter, a skilled grappler. He was great from the clinch, good striking, a cardio machine. As he's aged, though, we've seen that grappling really regress to the point where almost every time we see the guy lose, it's because he's getting out-wrestled. This was one of those times. He was clearly miles ahead of Gamrot on the feet, to the point in which Gamrot had no interest in striking with this guy. But his takedown defense left quite a lot to be desired. This was some Carlos Condit-esque takedown defense, in the sense that Gamrot secured almost every one he went for. It's a bit sad to say, because I've always enjoyed watching RDA, but unfortunately, it's something he's really struggling with at this point in his career.
Then we had Kyler Phillips defeating Pedro Munhoz by unanimous decision, 30-27 across the board. There was an eye poke by Phillips in the first round, and then Munhoz getting cut above his left eye from a punch. So he had that to deal with. This was just watching Kyler Phillips, who was a lot faster, much superior striker, and Munhoz, I mean, he's 37 years old at this point in time, and I think you have seen a certain level of regression there. A tough fighter, but this was more of a showcase for Kyler Phillips getting the win, and now winning seven of his last eight and winning three in a row, and a win over Song Yadong from several years ago that ages very nicely.
You know, this was interesting in the sense that I was watching this and I was thinking about Pedro Munhoz and just his last three fights. Okay, so we go back, and he has that win over Chris Gutierrez, a very dominant win for Munhoz, good fight. His other two fights, Marlon Vera and Sean O'Malley, both fights that you can very well argue that he either won or was on his way to winning in that one against O'Malley. So to see him in this 37-year-old Pedro Munhoz in this preliminary position, getting pieced up here by Kyler Phillips when he arguably had our two main eventers' numbers just in his last couple of fights. Very interesting how fortune did not favor Pedro here.
Yeah, and a guy that, I mean, he was 13th coming into this fight and could very well be unranked after this, even with those fights on his resume as well. But did Kyler Phillips impress you? Did you? I mean, Joe Rogan was in love with this guy.
He definitely did impress me. He's impressed me a lot recently. With that being said, one thing that we can say about Pedro Munhoz is he's clearly slowing down at this point. And I do mean that in the literal sense. The movement speed just isn't quite there. And when Phillips, his entire style, relies on movement so much, I think you really saw that speed disadvantage kill Munhoz here.
All right. The undercard, we're just gonna, like, I'll go over the results and then we'll isolate a couple of highlights. We had Philippe Lins defeating Iwan Kutalaba by unanimous decision, 29-28 across the board. Michel Pereira defeating Michael Olishechuk by rear naked choke with the technical submission when he went out. Robeles de Spain defeated Josh Parisian by TKO in all of 18 seconds. We'll definitely talk about him. And then we had Asul Almabayev over CJ Vergara by unanimous decision. Vergara missed weight for this fight, which is the third time in the UFC and fourth time in his career, which is maybe a sign that flyweight not working out so well for him. And then in her final fight, which she announced earlier in the week, Joanne Wood coming back after losing the first round to win a split decision against Marina Moroz. That was a rematch from 2015 when Moroz submitted Wood. A few very good performances here, but I think a lot will be focused on Robles de Spain, the bronze medalist from the 2012 Olympic Games in Taekwondo, whose his longest fight has been 4.5 minutes. And that is a marathon in comparison to his other lengths, including his last two fights that were 3 and 4 seconds respectively and going all of 18 in this one.
This guy's reach is ridiculous. He's just a giant human being, and he clearly knows how to use that power. This was one where he was moving backwards when he landed this knockout
blow. This was nuts. Like, he didn't even have, like, it was like a counter on his back foot as he landed, and the power this dude has. And I oversold. His last two fights were 3 and 2 seconds for Fury FC. And, yeah, I mean, this is someone that I could see absolutely he is – listen, Josh Parisian is like a fine entry-level heavyweight to be matched against. I mean, this guy could get just totally dominated by anyone in like your top 15. But man, is there going to be interest in this guy for his next fight? I mean, it's that unknown factor of somebody that you've seen so little of that has immense power that he commands with himself.
It was a great performance, but he just wasn't the star of these early prelims because that honor belonged to Michelle Pereira, who comes out with a complete choreographed dance routine, comes into the octagon, wins the fight in a minute, then breakdances his way out.
I thought this guy was going to tear his ACL on the entrance. Dana White, by the way, was asked about this. Hates it. Hates these entrances, of course. I mean, this guy sounds like just the life of the party.
Yeah.
Dude, Pereira, he just attacked the body. He hit a right kick, then a hard right to the body, and follows with knees to the body, and then he gets the most like unconventional rear naked choke, like no hooks applied. He's like at the side and just powers this dude down and puts him out in 61 seconds. From the minute he came out of the back to the end, this guy won the early prelims.
He's so entertaining. This is his 7th win in a row. The loss before just that
wild.
Is the DQ loss to Diego Sanchez in the fight he was dominating. Aside from that, just the Tristan Connolly fight where he gassed out and after the first round. This guy has been the better fighter every single time he stepped into the octagon across 2 weight classes. He's just a ton of fun. He's winning all of his fights. He's ranked, or he was ranked. He isn't now that he's at middleweight, but hell, give him a highly ranked opponent. Who cares? This guy is fantastic.
And other notes from the card. So Dustin Poirier, Benoit Saint-Denis was fight of the night. The performance of the night, they were extra generous on Saturday night, handing it out to everyone with a finish. Sean O'Malley, Jack Della Maddalena, Curtis Blaydes, Michelle Pereira, and Robles de Spain, all getting $50,000 bonuses as well. They did note Dustin Poirier doesn't get a finish bonus because he gets fight of the night. I mean, we can't be going crazy here, folks, okay? So that was UFC 299. Also on the broadcast, the announcement that Joanna Jędrzejczyk announced for the UFC Hall of Fame, joining Frankie Edgar and Wanderlei Silva. She was there in attendance, and that continues to round out the Hall of Fame class. We still have to get a fight, I guess, and maybe like one other entrant maybe that makes up the class.
That sounds about right. A layup for the Hall of Fame, Joanna Jędrzejczyk. No surprises there, really.
Kind of confirmation that, I mean, where have you been in terms of like the idea of, you've kind of heard the idea of her like flirting with a comeback over several years, but it does feel like pretty definitive at this point that she's probably not going to fight again now that it's been, she fought in 2022. And I think that the first Zhang Weili fight, I think that took a lot off of her career. Like, she did not fight for over 2 years after that war.
Definitely. With that being said, she'll be back soon. So,
okay. So there you go. Hall of Fame announcement / UFC 305. I'm back. So there you have it. And I would be remiss if I did not reflect on the fact that, as called by the man here on the show, Eric Marcotte, that on March 23rd, Junior Taffa will not be fighting Carl Williams and instead has been replaced by his brother, Justin Taffa.
It's so obvious,
amazing,
right?
An amazing replacement, as they basically twin magic themselves between fights around 5 weeks apart. So that is what is going to be happening. The real big fight over the next month when we get Carl Williams against Justin Taffa. But looking ahead to the UFC schedule, we have a bunch of fight nights before UFC 300, which are the fight night specials where you have one fight on top, maybe two. This card next weekend, tailor-made for you between Tai Tuivasa and Marcin Tybura. And Ovin St. Preux is back.
I thought Ovin St. Preux was retired.
No, he is back. He is on the main card here. I mean, there is, I'm sure there'll be some fine. Gerald Meerschaert, who, again, I'm convinced fights every other weekend.
Obviously.
Against Brian Barberina. I mean, this is an Apex card next Saturday. Then in 2 weeks' time, another Apex card with Amanda Hibas against Rose Namajunas. And second from the top currently, unless something else is added, we have Peyton Talbot against Cameron Simon, Edmund Shahbazyan against AJ Dobson, and of course, the real main event, Justin Taffa against Carl Williams. March 30th, there's actually like a big main event here with Aaron Blanchfield and Manon Fiorot. It should be to determine the next challenger, but Ultimate Fighter will probably sideline that. Chris Weidman against Bruno Silva. I mean, this could be it for Chris Weidman.
Chris Weidman. Oh my gosh. Yeah,
this is,
Oh no.
And Vicente Luque against Joaquin Buckley on that fight night card. Then going head to head the night of the first night of WrestleMania, will you have two screens on for Marvin Vettori and Brendan Allen?
You know what? I'll probably be at work. So,
and then we look ahead to UFC 300, and this is just a loaded card. Alex Pereira, Jamal Hill in the main event for the light heavyweight championship. Zhang Wei Li against Yan Xiaonan for the strawweight title. BMF title with Justin Gaethje against Max Holloway. So that's three potential five-round fights. Charles Oliveira, Arman Tsarukyan, Yuri Prochazka against Alexander Rakic, Aljamain Sterling versus Calvin Kattar, Bo Nickel against Cody Brundage, which they announced will be on the pay-per-view main card, Cody Garbrandt against Deiveson Figueiredo, Holly Holm against Kayla Harrison, also a veteran of other promotions FC, Diego Lopez versus Sadiq Youssef, Jessica Andrade against Marina Rodriguez, Jim Miller against Bobby Green, and just added Hanato Moicano against Jalen Turner. It's a fantastic card.
This is the best card I've ever seen on paper. This is so stacked. Almost every fight looks like it can be a super entertaining matchup. I'm genuinely excited for this.
So there you have it. That is the next time that we will be back chatting about UFC 300. We did get a super chat here from the one and only Brandon from New Jersey. Take two and action. Do you think Sean O'Malley's bravado will catch up with him for calling out Ilya Topuria? I don't think either fight will spreed with the spreed and grappling of Merab. I'll hang up and listen. Bet.
I'm a guy who typically listens to his podcasts through audio, but I suggest everybody seek out the video version of this particular show just so you can read Brandon's question here, because he does a number on the English language here.
Yeah, I think he took the same knee that Sean O'Malley delivered before typing this. But there you have it. I can read Brandon, though. It's a special fluency I have in his language. But thank you everyone for tuning in, whether it be for both of our post shows today or just one, depending on how early you were here. But thank you as always. Thank you to Eric for being very flexible. It is chaos on my end, but we had to do it a bit earlier today. But we will be back to our normal schedule, UFC 300 coming up April the 14th, Sunday, April 14th. We will be chatting with you then. Eric, a thank you as always. And you know, what is your final thought on UFC 299? Put a bow on this one.
Bet.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Goodbye.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.